6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. Good morning to you progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to people that spite me. Good morning to you, people that love me. Good morning to you, people that love Mark Riley. Good morning to you, and good morning to Mark Riley.
Hey, good morning.
Whoa, Mark Riley is almost on the air.
Good morning to you, my man.
Oh, there he is.
See, I see that? You got the Parmalat out, man.
The Parmalat, the box milk.
Yeah.
I buy the box milk. You know why? Because I'm irresponsible, Riley.
That's not being irresponsible. Let me tell you something. You go to most of the rest of the world, that's the milk that you see. You don't see the milk out in refrigerated whatever's like in most supermarkets.
That's because Parmalat never goes bad in the box.
No.
I buy the box milk because I know at some point I'm going to run out of regular milk and go, damn, I got a box of Parmalat. You know, I was watching CNN last night, and, you know, I don't care what anyone else thought of Hunter S. Thompson or whether he was, you know, important or not important, but, you know, they trivialized this guy on CNN like I could not believe. I'm already, you know, sick of CNN on a lot of levels, but it seems to be what kind of rolls on my TV when I'm at home. I just leave it on. And they did this little report where they said, they just said, well, Hunter S. Thompson's dead. Guy was all screwed up on drugs and stuff. You know, they basically said, this guy was great for that kind of thing. They showed some footage of him at a book signing, drunk. And, like, you know, sort of like, you know, kind of beside himself, which he sort of was. He was not a great public personality. They played Sympathy for the Devil underneath it. And then they pulled out of it. And I got to start writing these guys' names, these horrendous puppets on CNN that just sort of pop up, these talking heads. Forget the guy's name. When they came out of the clip of Hunter S. Thompson at this book signing, he was just like, basically gave that look of like, wow, that guy's a mess. You know, it was just completely disrespectful. I mean, granted, the dude was one of the great clowns of journalism, but he was an incisive, cutting, visionary clown who got to the truth one way or the other. But I just couldn't stand the way that it just made me hate the way they represent. The way they represent people that have some sort of past that is, you know, a little different than what they think is normal. They just make them look stupid.
Well, they always do this about outlaws. No matter what kind of outlaw you're talking about, whether it's Hunter Thompson or whoever, outlaws get this kind of treatment from the mainstream media, largely because, certainly in Hunter Thompson's case, I believe he was just not well understood by the mainstream. I don't think he ever made any pretense about wanting to be well understood by the mainstream.
Well, he's one of those guys that called people on their crap, you know, and he called people on their crap. And this guy was, they had a journalist. He used to travel with him on the campaign plane when they were on the press junket for the 72 campaign.
Yeah.
When he was writing that book. And he was like, yeah, we used to like Hunter. You know, he wasn't really a journalist, but, you know, he was funny.
No, Jeff Gannon isn't really a journalist.
But that's a great example. Most journalists aren't really journalists, and the ones that try to present themselves as being objective really aren't. The whole thing's a big sham right now, and this guy was like some sort of, you know, clown prince, you know, Hunter S. Thompson, because he had the freedom, because of the way he went about it, to actually say stuff that they couldn't.
Well, not just say stuff, but to be able to pinpoint precisely why journalism, you know, as a profession stinks, not in 1972, not just in 1972, but in 2004.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a guy who could sit there and say, hey, look, this is crap, and this is why.
Yeah.
And he could make it believable for people.
And now there's this feeding frenzy going on around. And the one quote that I love about that Thompson wrote in a recent interview in 2003, I believe the Republicans have never thought that democracy was anything but a tribal myth. That's very true. And the one thing that the story that's being floated now that got more press, and like, I don't know, I'm being Mr. Media Critic today because I sat in front of CNN yesterday while I was reading and writing and cooking beans and being a vegetarian and wondering why.
You're going to start up with Chris LaPresta now, aren't you?
No, I mean, it's like, you know, we got a bet going, but I'm telling you, I'm not comfortable with the lifestyle as of right now. How many beans can one guy eat? How much tofu can he eat before you're like, you know, oh my God, I am going to, you know, I'm going to have to move out of my apartment because I smell worse than the cats. You know, when do I cross that line? I haven't eaten any fish or nothing for 2 weeks. It's just beans and tofu and rice. It's good. It's tasty. But I'm a little grained out, LaPresto. I'm a little grained out.
Are you trying to kill yourself?
No, I'm not trying to kill myself. I was.
You're not even eating fish, dude.
I just haven't. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I'm eating too much of whatever it is. You know, I'm a little full of the grain. You know, but what was I was going to talk about? Here's what I was going to talk about. I remember now. Where were we headed with this? Oh, this feeding frenzy around these tapes of Bush when he was governor. It's BS, man. It's just BS. It's not real. These tapes, it's a setup. It's a smokescreen to dissuade people from what's really going on in the world. These tapes don't make him look any different than he already is. They're presenting it like, wow, this is some heavy stuff. Historians should be really sort of like, you know, tooling over this stuff. It's like there's nothing there.
This is no different than the tapes that Lyndon Johnson, you know, there were tapes that came out well after he died.
Yeah, but
they talked about, you know, he in unguarded private moments cursing about this, talking about that. These are things that presidents do. Presidents are people, okay? They're normal folks. And George W. Bush, I think, and we talked about this yesterday, Mark,
yeah.
I think he knew that he was being taped all along.
But I think they knew that they were going to drop him. This guy was some sort of, you know, big Amway operative. This guy was on board with the Republicans. There's no reason why this guy would turn on the guy. And when they interviewed him, this guy Weed on CNN.
Doug Weed.
Yeah, when they interviewed him on CNN yesterday, it didn't make any difference. He wasn't. They're presenting these things like there's something explosive about them. There's nothing but anything in the tape just reinforces, if anything, this guy's cagey and sort of insidious method of politicking. You know, in which, if anything, they make the tapes make him look smarter than you think he is. You can't never call this guy stupid again.
Well, see, what's so insidious about this is that, you know, Doug Weed is suddenly available for any and all media that wants to talk to him.
Oh, yeah, and he's got a book out.
Yeah, he's got a book out. You know, he's probably got handlers by now. He's got, you know, sitting up in somebody's green room taking calls on his cell phone. Oh, yeah, well, and what show are you with? I mean, it's an industry.
And how decisive and insidious Bush was about designing his public personality around Christianity, around, you know, sort of like, you know, spinning the drug use thing. This guy was a drug fiend. This guy was not a guy who tried pot. This guy was a blow monkey, pot smoking, and now he's a completely fake Christian. I got an email yesterday from someone like, when you said fake Christian, that really put me off. You know, I don't think attacking someone's faith is right. Yeah, well, tell me one Christian principle that this guy lives by. Tell me one, you know, element of Christian teachings that this guy honors, and then I'll tell you whether or not I shouldn't be attacking his faith.
It's a device. What he did, and the Weed conversations, they don't show anything else. They show that Bush's dalliance with the religious right was part of a calculated effort to gain the necessary support to win the Republican nomination for the presidency.
It was all calculated. I'm going to bet you, Riley, that not only did the guy, like you said, know he was being taped, but the tape was a plan that, you know, he was working on his talking points. This was a backup thing. This thing was dropped at a very strange time. There's a lot of things on the table that are trying to be muscled through Congress. There's a lot of things going on in relation to the press and in relation to the Gannon story. And this is one of those things. They're trying to make a big deal out of it. There's no big deal to be made, and they got all these right sympathizing historians on CNN. They got Heritage Foundation people commenting on it like this is like a real breakthrough. They're pretending like they're aggravated and upset by this, but they probably paid that guy off, for God's sakes.
I am outraged.
Ridiculous.
Look, George W. Bush, see, people need to start asking Doug Weed, well, hey, you've had these tapes for what, 7 years, 6, 7 years now? Why now? Why not 4 years ago? Why not 3 years ago?
Yeah, but also the tapes don't say anything. They don't do anything. It's a sham. It's just a sham. It just shows a politician, you know, crafting his future, you know, talking points. It just doesn't make any difference whatsoever. What are you going to learn from it? Wow, he's a much more insidious politician than we ever assumed. It's all an act, the dumb guy thing.
Well, he is who he is. And unfortunately, we have him for the rest of his 4-year term.
Well, when we come back, let's talk about the some of the people he killed in Iraq yesterday. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. That's right. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. That's right. Hey, I just want to reach out to somebody who reached out to me. To Mark Maron, you, Mark Riley, are great together. I listen to Morning Sedition every morning when I drive to work, I thought you'd get a kick out of this. You know, every morning while getting ready for work and driving to work, I thought you'd get a kick out of this book. Sincerely, Linda in Miami sent me a little cute book called Pills for Cats, Finding Happiness Through Modern Pharmacology. It's all about a cat who decides to go on medication. But it's a cute book, and I really appreciate the thought. I know some people love to hear about my cats, others not so much, but I'm going to go ahead and be a cat wuss right now. One of my cats, the one who is by far the most adorable of the three that I have left, as you know, Mimi is working in Brooklyn for Yemeni, and the one, LaFonda, who is the most adorable cat, was the sort of runtish of the litter and just spectacular gray cat, has finally let me start petting her. Big breakthrough, Riley.
Oh, okay. Big this is the one that was so hesitant, right?
Yeah, well, there were two. One of them is still hesitant but lets me do it despite herself. And it's the funniest thing because I'm like her. Like, you know, when people touch me, like my instincts are like, hey, what? Okay. All right, good. You know, that's not true. I love the affection. But this one knows instinctually that she shouldn't be being touched by a large human. But she lets it happen anyways. But the gray one is turning into, it's all very exciting. And I'll share it. I've been holding back on the cat stories. You know what I mean? Because some people are like, how long do we have to, you know? But other people, well, things are going well. And thank you for the lovely book, Linda, is what I am saying to you. And some other woman, a cat psychologist, sent me her card. I don't need that yet. And I don't know if I'll ever need it. I appreciate your input, but when it comes to psychology, I want these cats to deal with their problems, you know, in a hands-on way. I'll do some cognitive work with them, maybe set up a small 12-step group with the cats, you know, that kind of thing. So now moving into Iraq, which I'm not planning on doing soon, three Americans were killed yesterday.
Yesterday, yes.
Awful during what seemed to be a medical evacuation. A roadside bomb blew up beside a chopper that was, I think, ready to evacuate some people who were injured.
Yes, killed in action, now up to 1,124, which I thought was an awfully low number when I saw it in this article, Mark.
Mm.
But that is killed in action,
right.
Not just all the people
not
who
just
died.
Dead, yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Because that number is much higher
mm-hmm.
than 1,124.
Close to 2,000, I believe.
Yeah, it
mm-hmm.
is. What we now are seeing, yeah,
mm-hmm.
what we're seeing now
mm-hmm.
In Iraq is continued jockeying. I think a lot more jockeying than most folks in the States would initially think. We now have a situation where, of course, the United Iraqi Alliance, the UIA, has yet to name a candidate to stand for prime minister before the National Assembly.
And it's we thought the choice was Jafari, right?
Yeah, Ibrahim al-Jafari. He is still the front-running candidate.
Yes.
But apparently Chalabi,
yeah.
And you remember him.
Chalabi the liar? The embezzler,
yeah, Chalabi.
The guy who fed America, this administration, the information they wanted that would entitle them to go to the war that was based on lies. The one who's wanted in Jordan for being a thief.
A bank embezzler, I believe the term was. Yes, so, Ahmed Chalabi.
Credible guy.
Well, credible enough, apparently.
Yeah.
His people are telling whoever will listen, and apparently there are people in the press who will listen, that he's got the support of about 80 members of the National Assembly, which makes him a formidable, 80 members of the United Iraqi Alliance, because he's contesting within the alliance.
Mm-hmm.
He's contesting against Jafari. Now, what's interesting is that there's been a wild card here, and that is the current interim prime minister, Alawi, has thrown his hat into the ring. He's saying that his list, the list of people that supported him, who came in third in the election, now want him to stand for prime minister.
So now the concern is that they don't want the Shia to decide everything. Is that the deal? Is that, you know, if they pick the prime minister, if it's Jafari, and he is the one by the Iraqi United...
United Iraqi Alliance.
Yeah, United Iraqi Alliance. That there will not be a diversity of political voices, that they will have a sort of monopoly on what goes on a government level. Is that the fear?
Well, remember that Jafari represents the Dawa Party, which is one of the two major parties that formed the United Iraqi Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
The other party, which is the Skiris, the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, had their own candidate who later pulled out.
Right.
They are still horse trading, apparently, between the Skiri and the Dawa to to come up, you know, to unite behind Jafari. I don't know where or how Chalabi has managed to get as far as he has, but now Alawi has thrown his hat into the ring, and interestingly enough, the two of them, Alawi and Jafari, met the other day mm-hmm. for about an hour.
Mm-hmm.
To talk. Now, again, he is not, Alawi is not contesting within the United Iraqi Alliance. He's waiting until they pick a candidate, and then he will contest against whoever that candidate is when the National Assembly meets and decides to pick the president and the cabinet ministers, and from that comes the prime minister.
Okay.
So right now, it looks like it's a very, very curious situation, and of course, yet to be heard from in all this, and the X factor are the Kurds. The Kurds are looking for something very simple. They are looking for federalism.
Mm-hmm.
They are looking for a degree of autonomy that a theocracy would not allow in Iraq.
Right.
In other words, if the Shiite, if the United Iraqi Alliance goes too far toward theocracy,
mm-hmm.
that's going to anger the Kurds because the Kurds want their own autonomous situation.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to have to answer to Baghdad for everything that they do. They want some state. And interestingly enough, for example, Nigeria
mm-hmm.
is a prime example of a country that is the Federal Republic of Nigeria. That means each province has its own autonomy. That's why some of them, for example, have adopted the Wahhabi form of Islam, and that was why there was a big issue about a woman possibly being stoned to death.
Right. Now, isn't this sort of, but isn't that what the Shia have agreed to making this, you know, a parliamentary federalistic government? Have they not?
Not quite.
Well, okay.
Not enough so that the Kurds are now going to stand behind the UIA in terms of their candidate. Not yet. Has not happened. They're still negotiating.
So if they agree to a secular prime minister, you know, then maybe that these discussions can move forward.
They have to walk a very fine line here, Mark,
mm-hmm.
between secularism and the religious base that a lot of the followers of the Shia want to see put in place in Iraq. They can't alienate the Kurds, but they can't alienate their base either.
I get it. So when we come back, we're going to talk about Bush in Europe. Apparently, all the European leaders are allowed to ask one question, but only if they raise their hand and they're very nice. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio. Hilarious. 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio, this morning's edition. Man, off mic, some days we sound like a bunch of women in here.
Where?
Am I right, Kalo? Man, you know, I'm sitting here talking about the beans I made in my crock pot, and Kayla's like, well, how do I make pizza dough? I mean, my dough just won't rise. I'm like, oh, my God, we should be, you know, just sitting around knitting, for God's sakes.
And apparently my yeast has to be a certain temperature.
Well, I don't know. I don't do the baking. Baking's very delicate. You know, it's difficult. It takes a lot of nuance, and a lot of people are, you know, a lot of those recipes are sort of like people have improvised for years. Sometimes when you just take a recipe from a book and it's like something that you know and familiar with, you're getting just that recipe. And, you know, a lot of these people, that's why some pizza is better than others. You know, guys have been doing it for 30 years. They've created their own sort of system, their process. You got to just give yourself some time, Chris. And I didn't mean to characterize baking as being womanly, and that was wrong of me.
Yeah, because there's an awful lot of male bakers out here.
You don't got to tell me. You know, I'm just saying, no, but it's also just a stereotype that's not, that doesn't fit. But I guess I was feeling a little girly, might you say.
Uh-oh.
But not because of that. It's because I'm wearing this dress. But there's nothing wrong with that. Ramon just brought this. He just flown in. He was wearing a FedEx uniform.
Uh-oh.
This is George W. Bush's Palm Pilot for today, February 22nd. He's in Europe, okay, but we still, obviously, that's Ramon with the FedEx. 6:30 a.m. Wake up. Charm offensive continues. Remember, a stranger is just a friend who hasn't met me yet. All right. 9:20 a.m. Meet with the president of Ukraine, Brussels. Give him nickname. Dioxy, what's up, buddy? What's going on with the face? Okay, 10:35 a.m., meet with the Prime Minister of Italy. Tell him on my next European trip I want to visit the Goomba region of Italy, where they make the pizza like Halo. 11:05 a.m., go to the plenary session of the North Atlantic Council. Note, blah, 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 security, blah, blah, the fate of Europe, blah. This is Condi stuff. 4:45 p.m. Meet with the European Union leaders. Remember, each leader gets to ask me one question. Just one. Note, this is more Condi stuff. Move this along as fast as I can. I've got more charming to do. 6:45 p.m. Press conference with the European Council President, European Commission President. Tell the media, evildoers hate our charm. Yes. Okay. 10 p.m. bedtime in Brussels. Wow. Everyone's been so nice. I gotta scare that out of them somehow. That's a true story, Mark Riley. The true story is that one question for each of Europe's leaders. They're given topics. Am I reading this properly? That these guys
yes.
are given topics and they get to sit there while the monkey, ex-blow monkey, AWOL fake Christian puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult sits there to gets to sit there and go, okay, you know, I mean, what is that? How infantilizing can these guys be to foreign diplomats, to the world at large? The way Rumsfeld talks about Iraq, it's like, well, as soon as they get back on the bike, right, after you've blown the bike to pieces and taken their legs off, and then, you know, you get this thing where it's like, all right, who's raising their hand? Yes, the president of Russia, Putin. Yeah, how come zebras have stripes? You know, I mean, what is this?
He's not on the list, Putin, although Russia is on the subject list. George W. Bush, I guess in what you could describe as typical fashion, has gone over to a Europe, by the way, that really wants to reach some kind of accommodation with the guy. Now that he's been reelected, most of these European heads of state, including Chirac of France, including the Prime Minister of Belgium, and some of these other folks who parted company with him on the war in Iraq, now really want to sit down and make amends.
You know, it's weird. You look at Chirac. I looked at those two talking yesterday. That dude's all business. That's all he cares about. It's like, you know, how's this money going to come into France? What are you doing? How are you stepping on my deals? That dude, you just look at his body language, at the way he carries himself. It's all business with that guy. And it's so funny to see real people with real sophistication out in the world when, you know, monkey president goes out into the world and sits there with his, you know, dumb kind of like fake homey charm in the face of people that whose countries have, you know, a legacy of aristocracy and real sophistication and history, you know, that, you know, just hundreds and hundreds of years of princely behavior, and then, like, you know, our guy gets in there, like, hey, how's it going? Oh, when they let the
You know what he did? He is treating these heads of state the same way he would treat the White House press corps. That's the amazing thing. One question each,
really?
One issue each.
Is there a closeted homosexual European head of state that's going to ask softball questions?
I don't think so. Hmm. Although, I don't know. Any of these names look like,
you know,
Gannon?
What I was saying before is like, it's just like, I'm not making a judgment about, there are plenty of Americans that have a certain amount of sophistication. It's just our president isn't one of them. You know, he's just very graceless and has very little respect for behaving, you know, in a dignified way in public.
You know, each one of these heads of state will have about 5 minutes to address President Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got Bertie Ahern of Ireland talking about Russia. You've got the Prime Minister of, I'm sorry, the President of the Netherlands talking about counterterrorism. Berlusconi, who had to elbow his way on the list, by the way, of Italy, talking about economic reform. Tony Blair, and this is something he's very much concerned about because he's got an election coming up. He's talking about the Mideast peace process. Chirac, European integration. Zurinda of Slovakia will be he got the short straw, according to published reports. He's going to get to ask the president about Iraq.
Mm. Now, but what is this, a raffle? I mean, why do these guys subject themselves to this? They can't ask their own questions, or not big enough, or is it that the president, the puppet of the neocon death cult, our president Bush, is not versed enough to improvise? I mean, I don't understand why this was set up like that. Why couldn't they choose their own damn question?
I think what has happened here is that the White House has attempted to script this whole thing. In fact, you know, there are two EU buildings that Bush is visiting in Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have been emptied of about 2,000 workers
mm-hmm.
because the U.S. Secret Service was nervous. The buildings will essentially be empty as Bush goes through them. What's happening here is that this is a president who
I go, well, you guys got a job problem here too?
Yeah, right.
Employment problem?
Is this on?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at a point, Bush is trying to script this, and maybe it's, I guess, a sort of son of Gannon kind mm-hmm. of thing. These folks will deal with their problems with Bush after all this is done.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of the Kyoto. And see, you know, the Kyoto thing just kicked into effect, the Kyoto treaty.
The Kyoto treaty that we're not part of?
That we're not part of. And Europe is not happy about the fact that America is going to be, you know, perfectly comfortable with routinely violating the terms and conditions of this treaty. Now, that's not on the list that I can see. I mean, they talk about development goals, and they talk about Iran and the Balkans and the Barcelona process, but they don't talk about Kyoto. And Kyoto is on the minds of virtually all these European leaders.
Well, he paid some lip service to alternative fuel possibilities, hydrogen fuel, the magic car, of course, that runs on air. You know, he didn't say that he was going to change his mind about being involved in Kyoto and we being the biggest polluters in the world,
mm-hmm.
but he did pay some lip service to these, to the super secret flying car that they're working on. And, of course, you know, the personal propelling system that, you know, is going to, if you just change your diet, people will be able to fly.
Well, I mean, that's what he seems to be talking about. He's saying, you know, emerging technologies, these hydrogen-powered vehicles, electricity from renewable energy sources. But George W. Bush has got an end game here that is not just international, it's also domestic. And that is to get up there in Alaska and start drilling for oil.
Yeah, if there's oil up there. And also, another thing is that this doesn't even take into consideration the fact that by continually polluting the environment, allowing this to happen, what are we setting up? What do you think's going to happen? I mean, they're linking this to the rise in infectious disease rates. They're linking this to the possible, you know, onslaught of Armageddon, which some of these people are hedging their bets on. And the bottom line is about the Arctic Reserve is there might not be anything in there. It's 43 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Oh, yeah. 47 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley over there.
Yes, it is.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. That's it. It is Morning Sedition, and that is the sound of our fax machine here from the Streisand compound is the liberal agenda for today. Hear your marching orders, good liberals. One, call all your European friends and tell them if they want Bush to stay there permanently, it's okay with us. Keep the bastard. Two, casually tell the annoying neocon at the office, I can't believe Jeff Gordon beat Dale Jr. to win the Daytona 500. Looks like it's a number three for old Jeff, and wait for a reaction. Three, secretly start tape recording your friends for history, not for money. Four, recover from last night's Lincoln's fabulous gay birthday rail splitters ball.
Oh,
nice. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. The leaders of Europe only get to ask Bush one question. Well, I got a million questions, and they all end with, how do you sleep, murderer? Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. Get on with you.
How do you sleep, murderer?
How do you sleep, murderer?
You're a rough guy.
I am not a rough guy. I'm
all right,
trying to help.
Rough.
Trying to help. Oh, no, I'm a little rough. So let's say the first time that George W. Bush proposed drilling for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska, or ANWR, as they call it, that was in 2000, all right? Now, apparently a lot of things have happened since then, Riley. Like, a lot of oil speculators and oil companies went up there and said, I don't know if there's really not a big deal up here.
This is totally speculative on the part of both the Bush administration and the oil industry. We're talking about 1.5 million acres in Alaska. And, of course, you have the Alaska congressional delegation coming down four square in favor of allowing drilling on what should be a wildlife refuge. You know, they don't exactly have big rigs drilling for oil in Central Park here in New York now, do they?
No, that would be awkward unless Cristo did it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then, and it's not an oil rig, it's art.
The gates, then the oil.
About, but the interesting thing to me is that, you know, not only is the refuge beautiful and a national park, but apparently in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, or in the 80s even, there was some speculative drilling done outside, just outside of the borders, the parameters of ANWR. And the oil companies, they kept this information hidden for a while, these tests.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one that was inside Anwar that was a test drilling, and they really didn't come up with enough oil to justify a big movement into Anwar. And the interesting thing that's going on now, I think, Riley, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it seems that many of these oil companies that were once behind this thing, you know, are not behind it anymore. They don't really care. This move towards domestic oil production in Anwar is sort of a sham because, you know, none of the oil companies seem to be backing. But as you said, the Alaskan congressional lobby is against it, is for it, because they think it creates jobs. This is very short-sighted, though, because they just see drilling jobs. And ultimately, if there is no oil there, why is Congress so dead set on getting this through?
Well, because at one point the Bush administration is dead set and has been dead set on getting it through. But it's getting to the point now that for Bush, this is like, what if you give a party and nobody shows up? The oil companies are people that drill where they think they're going to strike oil and where they think they can make a whole bunch of money. There's no guarantee that drilling in Anwar is going to work that way. But for the Bush administration, Anwar is just the tip of the iceberg. There are people who want to drill, for example, in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. There are people who want to drill off the coast of Florida. There are people who want to drill off the coast of California. All of these options have been politically unpalatable, even though there is we need fossil fuels in this country. But nobody wants to see too many oil rigs off the coast of Florida. Nobody wants to see oil rigs off the coast of California. It's too hot a political football. So where do they turn? They turn back to Alaska, where at least they got a congressional delegation that's behind them.
So they're trying to set a precedent. Now, I guess the reason that we're talking about this right now is because ConocoPhillips just recently pulled out of this. They said that they're not going to be part of this. And there's only one remaining oil company that's even marginally interested, and that's ExxonMobil.
Yeah. They have an organization called Arctic Power. Mm-hmm. It's a lobbying group. And one by one, the oil companies have been abandoning their funding for it. Now, ironically enough, Arctic Power is also funded by the state of Alaska. The state has an interest in trying to get drilling done in the Anwar. And I think a lot of these folks feel like they've just, like, been abandoned as they were on their way to the prom or something. These are some of the same people that sat with Dick Cheney in 2000 during the transition to the first Bush term and developed an energy policy that involved drilling in the Anwar. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden they don't want to do it. And the administration is still pushing forward four square in the idea with the idea that they will find some serious amounts of oil there, although there is there have been some estimates that have said it would only, even, you know, if they hit a gusher, they would end up hitting about maybe 5 to 6% of the nation's energy needs could be, and that's a percentage of the U.S. daily oil needs that Anwar could fill.
And isn't this interesting? This is like, a day, we're talking about this the same day that the president is paying lip service towards doing research in alternative fuels and alternative energy resources. And clearly, what you're telling me, if I understand it properly, is that he is trying to set a precedent with congressional support in order to open up other natural wildlife preserves and national parks to go ahead and start drilling.
Yeah. What he really wants to be able to do is drill any place the oil companies feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, these are speculators. These are folks who, make their money off looking for oil. And when it comes to the point that the drilling and the cost oversteps the bounds of what they think they can make, that's it. And I think that's what's happened as far as Anwar's.
Right. The quote that we have from Matthew R. Simmons, energy industry banker and a 2000 Bush advisor, is, quote, if you can't do Anwar, you'll never be able to drill in the promising areas. Promising, i.e., beautiful places where people go for some respite. Is that what you call
respite.
It? Some respite from the horrendous pace of the world. Why not just drill, in Yosemite? Why not just drill in the bottom of the Grand Canyon? Why not just drill wherever they feel like drilling? Why not make a mess of this place? What is their rationalization? See, in my head, Mark Riley, the idea that the Alaskan Congress, that the legislature is behind this because of because it creates jobs, is incredibly short-sighted and very telling about the momentum of the free market in this country and the way Republicans think. I mean, what if there is no indication that this will serve the world or even accommodate any of our, you know, marginal energy needs in a big way. Why destroy the place just because you're going to have a few people that are going to get some work for maybe a year or two while they build these big drilling rigs, plow holes into the, you know, the Arctic Reserve, you know, disrupt the ecosystem, kill, you know, whatever's remaining up there, or make it more difficult for them to for the animals to live properly. And I'm no big, you know, environmentalist guy. You know, I don't go out and you know, protest things, but this is completely, you know, unreasonable in terms of the short-sightedness, in terms of destroying the environment for what, temporary jobs. It's ridiculous.
Even the oil pipelines that crisscross Alaska now have disrupted the environment for wildlife. I mean, this, and I'm not saying this out of school. This is something that has been established by the same government that George W. Bush now heads.
You got to be careful of this stuff because, you know, I just saw a study today, outside of just being wrong, you know, and not respecting the nature's ecosystems, is that by disrupting ecosystems enough, you bring on disease, you bring on global environment changes, you bring on, you know, what are they trying to escalate? Armageddon? Are these people so religiously fanatic that they think it's just part of destiny that we destroy this place? Or is it that these are just short-sighted capitalists that really think that there's a new business in fixing what we've broken? That I really believe this is true, that as much as they're destroying the world, they're sitting there going, well, think about the new industries we'll have in cleaning up the mess.
Look, you know, you mentioned earlier the very secret drilling, test drilling, mm-hmm. that has taken place in the Anwar already. This was going back to the 1980s. And logically speaking, Mark Maron, if they found something to be optimistic about, you don't think those oil companies would be right behind George W. Bush on this?
Right, exactly. And they're one of the guys from the oil company in secret said, look, you know, they pretty much just indicate that there's nothing there. We were there.
Exactly. Nothing there.
It's all political, so they can start drilling everywhere. In your backyard, perhaps.
Oh, huh? Man, please, not that. Never that. When we come back, we're going to talk more about Anwar and its implications. We're also going to have Mark Maron's dream diary.
Mm-hmm.
All for you here on Air America Radio.
Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
That's right, it's 6 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Hi.
You are the geniuses and philosopher kings and queens of our audience, working class heroes. Good morning to all of you. We're talking about Arctic drilling in Anwar, drilling for oil where there might not be much oil. Before we get back into that, I do want to say, Riley, that I am a little nervous about this afternoon, my friend.
Why?
Why? Because we're going to a screening of the documentary that they made about the beginning of Air America Radio that's going to be on HBO. And if I can think back on what I might have been like when I didn't know how to do this as well, I'm not saying I'm any pro at it yet, but boy, at the beginning, I didn't know what I was doing. There were three of us. I was, like, freaking out every 5 minutes for reasons that are, I just can't even imagine what I look like in this thing. I'm yelling at Clutch Larson. I'm, you know, who the hell knows what I look like?
Well, why worry?
What, are you kidding me? I know what it's look. I know what it feels like to look stupid on television. I've been on television a lot, my friend.
Uh-huh.
And I've looked stupid at least three times.
Well, you know, we
and you know what? I remember every one of them, Riley.
You remember every one of them?
I remember every second of while I was doing it, and I remember watching it for the one time that I did.
So why are you going to torture yourself now and go and watch it, and then you'll come out of there seething with anger?
Can a guy have hobbies?
Oh, okay.
All right. Maybe self-torture. Hey, what are you doing today? I'm going to beat myself around a little bit. You mean like beat on the bag, you know, a little bit? Maybe do a little boxing? No, I mean beat myself up from the inside, get that kind of workout, take a nap, have some ice cream, cry, you know, the same.
The usual.
I don't cry. I don't cry at ice cream. I only cry for the right reasons now. You know, commercials, sitcoms I haven't seen in a long time. Anytime where people get along nicely at the end, every once in a while when my cats are lying together, licking each other's ear, I have a moment I'm like, oh, what's wrong with me? But anyways, moving on, I just wanted to throw that in. I'm concerned about some stuff. Okay. So the Congress wants. Let's talk about who wants to push through this drilling. But first, I want to know, Riley, is that a year ago? And it's just come to light that a year ago, Conoco, however you want to pronounce it, we used to pronounce it Conoco in New Jersey, but that's New Jersey.
Okay.
How do you pronounce it?
Conoco.
Amoco. They pull out. They're
yes.
like, this is it.
Now, this is out of Arctic Power, which is a lobbying organization that was formed by a partnership between the oil industry and the state of Alaska, specifically to be able to drill in ANWR, which is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Now, let's make clear that this could go in front of Congress, you know, in less than a month if this Arctic Power, organization, this lobbying group, gets its way. Now, the problem is that not only did Conoco pull out, but, you know, Chevron and Texaco has not been a member of Arctic Power since 2000. British Petroleum, in July 2003, British Petroleum shut down productions at its Badami oil field, the closest wells to ANWR, and that was, you know, comes from a story in 2003. Badami apparently had fallen way short of anticipated production for 5 years. It had hoped to drill 30,000 barrels per day at Badami, BP did, but now it was down to 1,400 barrels a day. So this thing is a crapper. It's a bad speculation. It ain't there. All right, so they pull out. ConocoPhillips pulls out a year ago. We just find out today. The only one that's hanging in is ExxonMobil for whatever reasons that they think, even their chairman, Lee R. Raymond, said in December, I don't know if there's anything in ANWR or not. So they don't. He's just hanging in because what the hell? And then you got a president who's sitting there wanting to push this through because they want to clearly make it okay to drill in these kind of places anywhere in the country, right? But he's a guy that has failed oil. This is our president is a failed oil man, all right? He has drilled more dry holes than any president ever, all right? And I'm not even talking about, hey, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going there. All right, now, the thing is that this is a guy that, you know, he was involved in Arbusto Oil, which is Bush in Spanish. It was, his little oil company that tanked out. All right. This was in 1977 that he put this together. All right?
Oh, he's got a history.
Sure. Bush attempted to take Arbusto public in 1982 with bad results. All right. Bush changed the name to Bush Exploration, you know, just so people would forget that Arbusto was a tanker. In 84, Bush Exploration merged with Spectrum 7 Energy Corp of Ohio. And he was made CEO for, you know, $75,000 a year salary in stocks and whatever. Spectrum 7 in 86, 2 years later, teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, was bought by Harkin. Okay. Now, Harkin, gave him a consulting contract. Harkin was a real company. They really carried this guy for a while. Okay. And then the deal was that Harkin went into business here's how it goes. Harkin owns a gasoline retailing business in 19 states, gas pipelines in Texas and Louisiana, slightly fewer than 7 million barrels of oil and gas reserves in the U.S. Despite never having drilled an oil well overseas, Harkin lands a contract with a tiny Persian Gulf country in Bahrain to explore and develop petroleum offshore. So this is a deal that Bush made through Harkin with, you know, some, you know, Arabs, right?
Okay. One named Salem bin Laden.
There you go. So there you go. So now they drill this thing. They speculate that there's oil. They build a big offshore drilling rig. Nothing. Gets nothing. So all I'm building up to is that not only is our president a failed businessman, but he's a gambler with other people's money. And now he's saying, look, let's get behind this thing. You know, I know what I'm doing. He doesn't know what he's doing. He drills dry holes, you know, and he's, you know, the only reason he made his fortune was because a bunch of people carried him on the Ranger thing.
Well, I mean, when you look at Bush Exploration, they had debts of $3 million, and yet Harkin paid them $2 million, paid Bush $2 million for his stock. This is some very interesting stuff. This is how people are able to fail upward.
Yeah, well, he was taken care of because of his name, because of what they thought it would mean for him to have him around on the board, you know, with this oil company. But the guy's been a failure, and this is a guy that wants to gamble with, you know, other people's money. On Social Security, on these oil rigs, on the, you know, Arctic wildlife preserves. It's crazy to trust this guy with anything. And ultimately, as we said before, the goal is to set a precedent to drill in any national park or anywhere they really want to, especially places that were off, you know, off limits.
Yeah, off the coast of Florida, off the coast of California. Democrats have stopped, I'm talking about now Democrats in Congress, they have stopped nearly every mini initiative to start oil drilling off the coasts of the United States. I mean, a lot of people, after the Exxon Valdez, Mark, when all that oil ended up spilling into the, you know, into the environment, the Democrats in Congress, and some Republicans as well, we should say it's been a bipartisan effort, they have been very, very nervous about allowing wholesale drilling anywhere, mm-hmm. least of all close to the coasts of the United States. Could you imagine what politicians would end up having to pay if suddenly there was like oil washing up on the beaches of like Santa Monica or along the west coast of the United States? And that's a possibility. You never know what happens when you start drilling for oil. The thing is, these big oil companies do want to be able to drill in these places because they think there might be oil there. In fact, they think that there might be more oil off the coast of California or off the coast of Florida or in the Gulf of Mexico than up in Anwar.
Yeah,
that's why they're abandoning Anwar.
Yeah, but the oil companies are, but apparently our president isn't, and Arctic Power isn't, because of the political move that would justify drilling in those other
exactly.
places.
Exactly.
So the oil companies are going to sit this one out until these guys do their dirty politics and make it okay to pillage the planet even more without even putting any money into research for alternative fuels, alternative energy resources. This is this guy's bread and butter. This particular old boys network that is running this planet right now is all about oils and guns. That's all they're about. They're not about doing anything proactive in terms of peace. People of the world. In February 10th, Alaska Governor Frank Murkowski named this guy Jerry Hood to head the Washington office of Arctic Power. Hood is a former Alaska Teamsters chief who supported drilling in Anwar, saying it would create jobs. All right, they don't know how much you're paying this guy, and you know he's been pushing for drilling from the beginning. And this short-sightedness about creating jobs to set a precedent for political, you know, evil animals is ridiculous. And you would think that the people of Alaska would definitely have a problem. And we happen to have someone on the phone who is calling from Alaska, and we will talk to them when we come back. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
We were talking about Arctic Power drilling in the Anwar. But we're going to talk about that in just a second. Let me just get this out. It's my dream diary from last night. It's very important. My therapist's not going to be in this week. I'm in a high school gym full of liberals. I've decided to take action and organize a meeting to strategize how we can bring down the neocon death cult in 2008. I step up to the mic. Evening, everybody. Glad you can make it. Now, if you can turn to page one on the agenda, a woman in a velour tracksuit stands up. Excuse me, something smells really bad in here. I have perfume allergies, and I would really appreciate it if someone could open a window or something. Please, thanks. Then a guy in a beard says, hey, there really should be hand dryers instead of paper towels in the bathroom. Am I the only one here that cares? That cares about the environment? Then some dude in a ponytail says, hey, dude, does this thing have to be so uptight, man? I mean, can't we just talk? Then a woman in a peasant dress says, before we get started, I'd like to recite a poem about the grass. Then a girl with a crew cut says, I assume you knew this, but today is the 26th anniversary of the Three Mile Island disaster, and I think it's totally, totally inappropriate for us to meet right now. Then another woman says, why does this straight white man always have to set the agenda? What have you got against gay black women, huh? Huh? An old man in an overcoat says, so warm in here. We're wasting fossil fuels keeping this place so hot. Money we're made of, huh? Then a mom says, does someone know where I know sign language? Anyone, please? Sign language? Then a large woman in a snowflake sweater says, Mark, how are your cats? I have cats. Cats are neat. Then a goth kid says, hey, tell a joke, Maron. This is boring. Then a guy in a leather jacket says, I thought there'd be more chicks here. Then a middle-aged guy in a suit says, this isn't an AA meeting, is it? Do you know where that one is? The meeting went on like this for 4 years until the 2008 elections were over. I woke up and my bed was filled with situational ethics. Deep.
Ooh.
So now, dig this. Arctic Power is a private lobbying group funded privately and by the state. It has offices in Alaska and in Washington, D.C. Its primary purpose is to open the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve for drilling. Co-chairman Al Adams says, quote, we're getting the D.C. office set up. We're going to start hitting the 435 House offices and re-educate them about ANWR. All right. According to the Alaska Sierra Club, Arctic's power spokesman spokeswoman claims the organization is aggressively seeking private funding, but the state pays for about a third of its estimated $3 million a year budget. The Alaska Sierra Club claims that past Arctic Power records show expenses such as, quote, whining and dining at Hooters in Anchorage and racist billboards that showed if you don't support ANWR development, you are supporting the ragheads. All right, now we have a gentleman on the phone from Alaska who's going to tell us a little bit about how this relationship with the state of Alaska and with the Arctic Power functions and what he's done about it. Joe in Anchorage, good morning.
Morning, Joe.
Hello?
Turn off your radio, Joe.
I think he must have stepped away from his phone. It sounds like he's
Hello?
There. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
Can you hear us, Joe?
All right, this call is not quite working out. So see if you can get him on or whatever, how that happens. But, hopefully what he'll be able to tell us is how apparently they're in cahoots with the Alaskan, they're paid dividends from the Arctic Power when they do the drilling. Is that how that works?
I believe it is how it works.
Okay.
It's split with the between the federal government, I guess, and the state of Alaska, and individual Alaskans actually get the money. I don't know if we have Joe on the line. Okay, we do not have Joe.
Well, you know what's scary to me, ultimately, is that, I don't know what the end game here is. I just don't understand how these guys can continue to destroy the environment and not think that ultimately we're going to pay for it. And apparently, there are some Christian organizations that actually believe, that it's our duty on some level to go ahead and deplete the planet of everything. Do you understand? It's actually part of it. See, they have this reasoning that if Armageddon is going to happen, it's going to happen. And there's nothing we can do about it. That, that if Armageddon is going to happen, we can't be afraid of it. And there's no reason not to deplete everything and kill all the animals and make the environment horrible. If that's the way the world's going to go, then that's the way it's going to go. Joe, do we have Joe?
I hear you guys now.
Hey,
oh, that's
Joe.
Tremendous. Joe, can you explain some stuff to us about... about it. That must have been weird. Hearing us yell at you on your radio, but not being able to talk to us.
Yeah, well, up in Alaska, we have this often. Go ahead, guys.
Okay, so tell me, you're just a regular guy up there, and you have, just by being a citizen of Alaska, you have a certain relationship with Arctic Power.
Well, the situation up here is the dividend check. That's probably what you're talking about.
Yes.
I arrived in Alaska in 64.
Wow, right after the earthquake?
Right after the quake. My mother lived up here. She was connected with the court system. I've had a long career with jury selection and evidence presentation and such. And I've made presentations to the legislature about this dividend problem. As a matter of fact, I was a consultant to Alaska in the state in the years when then Governor Hammond was creating what's called a permanent fund.
Okay.
And the permanent fund is designed because what we are doing is spending the revenue from oil as though it were income.
Okay.
The revenue from oil is an asset being liquidated.
Okay.
It only comes in once, in other words.
Okay.
The money that only comes in once, it's like selling a kidney to go to Disneyland.
Oh, yeah. See, that's what I was trying to figure out. And also, it just seems that given that the speculators say there isn't that much oil up there, a lot of oil companies
are
pulling.
There's a lot of speculation about the Arctic Wildlife Reserve.
So this is just a cut-and-run operation where they create a few jobs, they deplete some money out of the state's economy, and they leave.
And because of the dividend check, and I even wrote to the newspaper, I write once in a while, and spending our assets as though they were income is depriving the kids of a future here in Alaska. This money has been invested. It should be drawn like an endowment. But they are short-sighted up here. That's the only reason I raise that point.
But that seems sort of criminal, that whole operation. Isn't that sort of how Enron sucked the money out of California?
It is an Enron thinking. If we are the stockholders of the state of Alaska, so to speak, and if we are getting a dividend check, while the real management, the legislature, is liquidating our corporate assets, it's a terminal...
It's horrible.
A terminal situation.
Thank you so much for your call, Joe. Appreciate the information a lot. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you for the energy. Thank you.
You bet. Okay, bye. That it's just incredible that this administration will support any racket that does that, that just denies people and denies states of you know, they just deplete states. They're just, it's like third world. It's what they do in the third world. They say, we're going to come in, we're going to do this, we're going to get state support around it, and then they suck the money right out of the state and say, good luck.
It's a racket.
866-303-2270 is our number. We have the liberal confessional coming up, so if you've got something eating at your progressive value system of a transgression of some sort of dark secret, 866-303-2270. I'll tell you mine if you tell me yours. Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition. Don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. Hey, Clutch Larson, keep an eye on the board. Do some thinking for yourself, okay? Just, you know, you see what's going on there? All right, we got a lot of calls. All right? 866-303-2270. No, I know it. I know Brendan P.W. McDonald's in there. I just want you to look and see what people are thinking and saying.
Yeah.
You know, this is a group effort here, right, Kayla? The Costco ho.
Right.
Riley's right here.
Yeah.
Look, it's not always easy being a liberal. We all stray from the straight and narrow from time to time, but when we need to unburden ourselves, we can always confess our liberal sins. If you want to take a turn in the liberal confessional, give us a call at 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. But right now, it's my turn. Bless me, Brother Riley, for I have sinned.
How can I ease your burden, my son?
Well, I've been feeling a little muddled lately about my commitment to this thing, you know, the liberal cause and what I'm doing here at the radio station.
In what way?
Well, I get paid to do this, Riley, as do you.
Yeah?
There are people out there who do what we do for nothing because of their commitment to all things liberal. You dig it? I don't know if I could do that. If this place hadn't agreed to my new contract thing, would I even be here? Do I care enough?
Does it have to be so cut and dried? Maybe. It's a balance between what you earn and your belief that what you do is important.
Well, I'd like to think that, all right? But part of me thinks that if I wasn't making the bucks I wanted here, I'd be out in Los Angeles fighting tooth and nail for the abusive bookstore clerk role on some Paul Reiser project. That'd be a recurring role, of course, but maybe what I really believe in is money and my comfort level, right?
Money and comfort. Well, those then are the two areas you should be addressing in your penance.
All right. Hit me, Brother Riley. What do you got?
Right after the show today, I would like you to go over to a taping of MSNBC's Scarborough Country.
Wow, that's harsh, man. That's okay. That's fine.
And?
What?
I'm not done.
Okay.
I would like you to put on a tight neon green Lycra onesie with a large red W stitched on the chest.
And where am I going to get that?
I've had this one sitting around just for such a day. Here, Mark.
All right. Well, what, the W's for horror, right? I think I see where this is going.
If that's how you feel, then I want you to volunteer yourself as a regular guest on Scarborough Country.
Oh.
You will introduce yourself as Mark Maron, whore, your word, and host of Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
I don't know. I can't. I can see where my comfort level will be addressed by this, but I...
Let me finish. And as Joe Scarborough's guest, you will let him bend you across his desk and let him spank you on the air.
Oh, dude, what if Scarborough's not into that?
Oh, he is, trust me.
Uh-huh.
And for every spanking he gives you, you will donate $20 to Head Start, which is facing cuts under Bush's new budget.
Well, what if he spanks me a lot? I mean, like 20 times, that's, I'm no good at math. But besides, it seems like a pretty unseemly way to help kids.
Even if kids watch Scarborough Country, Mark, they just see some skinny buffoon in a Lycra suit getting spanked by a guy with a wild, crazy look in his eyes.
Huh.
They don't have to know Scarborough's getting off on it. And with issues of money and comfort dealt with, maybe you can then concentrate on being the best liberal talk show host you can be. Now go forth and sin no more.
Man, well, thanks, Riley. Wow, this is... Well, okay, now, all right, I feel better. I got to wear this. All right, well, if anyone else wants to confess, 866-303-2270 is the number, and the liberal confessional is open. Christy, what is your sin, Christy?
Hi. Oh, brothers, you've got to save my soul here.
Okay.
We'll try.
Listening to you this morning, I have to confess that several years ago, my father, who is a very good Republican, gave me some stock in Exxon,
okay.
And I still have it 15 years later.
Uh-huh.
And I've always wanted to get rid of it, and you just are making me feel terrible today.
Okay.
What can I do? I don't even know how to get rid of it.
What? You don't even know how to
get rid of it?
You can't even consider getting rid of it because it's just there's too much money there? Is that the deal?
No, it's like a measly $500, but I'm clueless. But
Is that all it is?
That's all it is.
Oh, well, you've got to sell that stock and take that money and give it to a bird. You just have to go up to a bird with a little wad of money and go, take this and go help your friends. or maybe, you know, just take the money and drive, you know, drive past a place where there are a lot of people on the street that have no place to live and throw the money at them.
Well, I can do that. Can I just give them the stock? Do I have to sell it?
Yes. Walk up to a homeless guy and give them the stock certificate. That's a great idea. And don't sign it over to him. Just say, I don't know what to do with this.
You take it.
Good luck with everything.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, see you later.
All right, Christy. Wow.
Oh, you ever seen those things? Stock certificates are so official looking. I don't have one, but I have a bar mitzvah bond, which I assume looks similar. Don't you think?
Probably, and it's probably worth a lot of money.
You think it is?
Maybe.
Now, I don't know if there's a cap on those things. I got these bar mitzvah bonds from the Bank Leumi. Is that the Israeli?
Oh, Bank Leumi.
Bank Leumi, yeah. And I've had one, and I almost went over to Bank Leumi with my bar mitzvah bond to go, my grandma gave me this. You know, but I think it's only worth $100, and I just, does it keep going up? I don't know. Because
check and see.
Yeah, what's the matter with me? Why don't I just check and see? Now I got to remember where I put that thing. But you know when you find stuff, you're like that. Every time you see, like, I got these bonds from when I was in the bar mitzvah, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm probably rich by now. And you call up, it's like, it's worth $117.42. Really? 20 years later? 30 years later? All right. No, never mind. So what? I'm not going to be rich. Dave, listening to LIB in New York.
Hello.
Hello, Dave. What's your sin?
Sin is, one is a liberal, the usual liberal agenda about believing in euthanasia, but mine goes a little further. And I kind of believe that if children are born deformed or, let's say, physically disabled, or where they would be, you know, impaired cognitively, that I think that we shouldn't use any kind of advanced technology,
yeah.
Advanced technology to keep them alive.
Oof. Boy, that's
rough.
Man, talking about a buzzkill. Good morning. All right, so you're saying kill the crippled kids, basically, because it's not...
I feel guilty about this.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't want to mock you. Well, I tell you, so here's what you got to do. First of all, you know, this is an interesting topic because it is a real issue because as a liberal, we are somewhat acute and sensitive to people's suffering and people's pain. And sometimes when you see these type of kids in the world, you assume that their suffering and their pain and the pain they cause their parents is so overwhelming that wouldn't it be easier?
That's what I say.
Yeah. Well, my personal experience, and this is outside of your penance, and just in honesty, because I just ran into a friend of mine who I grew up with. He's got a kid who is, he has cerebral palsy, so he's severely compromised. But I tell you, this kid brings a tremendous amount of joy into the world and into these people's lives, despite the fact that he has this handicap. I understand what you're saying, but, you know, on some level, sometimes the human spirit, even in a mangled sort of compromised form, brings a tremendous amount of poetry into people's lives. They operate in a different time zone, but I think that in some situations, what you're saying is more understandable than others. But your penance, I think, is to, you have to go to see Matt Fraser's show. Matt Fraser is a guest we had on. Do you live in New York?
Oh, yes. I know what you were talking about.
You're going to have to go see. You got to go see
Flid.
The Flid show. All right,
right.
Number one.
What's it called again?
The Flid show.
Right.
FLID. Go see that. And, you know, maybe see, you know, do a little film festival with yourself and watch My Left Foot and The Elephant Man and try to you know, get a different understanding around this stuff. So what you're saying in terms of, like, if a kid is born headless or not able to breathe without a machine, I think the argument can be made in your favor in some respects. But, you know, if it's just, the other stuff, Maybe there's some joy to be had there. Am I making any sense, dude?
You're making sense, and I'll think about that.
All right. Well, and your penance is to go see the Flint show, because that guy, you know, he's got some serious birth defects going on, but he's a pretty good performer, good entertainer, and has a lot to say about being alive in the world with the birth defects.
And for people who don't know what we're talking about in terms of Flint is slang for thalidomide babies. Mm. And thalidomide, of course, was a medicine that was given to women during the 1960s, and many of their children turned up deformed.
Thanks for your call, man. I'm surprised that I got so involved with that. But, you know, it's weird. It's a very interesting thing that when you see somebody going through that, especially my friend of mine with his kid. And I'll tell you, my friend Sam has now, you know, really dedicated his entire life to helping kids and to making life easier and to learning how to communicate with these kids who are compromised, you know, mentally through birth defects. And his kid, Zach, is just a great kid, mm-hmm. you know, and it's going to be difficult as that kid gets older and stuff, obviously, but the amount of joy and excitement, and it's a whole other world when people are compromised like that, because you have to learn how to communicate in their language, you have to develop ways of communication. It's pretty fascinating discussion. Anyways, let me move on. Chris, in Boston, what's your sin? Hello, Chris.
Dr. Mark?
Yes.
Hey.
Yeah. What do you have to confess to us, my friend?
Well, I'm having this problem. I play on this recreational hockey team.
Yeah.
And I had this teammate who I had noticed was kind of belligerent and wing nutty, and I recently confirmed that he is, in fact, very belligerent and very wing nutty. Writes awful right-wing blog, and I just can't even look at him, and if I'm on the ice, I don't think I could even pass him the puck. I think I'm letting my team down, but I just can't get over this.
So you don't even want to putt that guy, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So, look. I hear what you're saying. So, you don't want to be a team player because you hate this guy so much. You want to deny him the opportunity to even get involved in the game.
Yeah, and it's not even really that personal because I don't know him very well, but I'm aware of what his politics are.
But you know him enough to know that he's a belligerent ass, yes?
Right, and, you know, being a Massachusetts liberal, you're really not exposed to this type of person very often, so I'm often taken aback.
Well, you're in the interesting opportunity to perhaps do something powerful. We'll discuss it when we come back. Your penance. Please stay on the phone. It's 45 past the hour. We're taking liberal confessions. 866-303-2270. We'll come back with Chris's penance after this. It's Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Past the hour, we're in the middle of a liberal confessional segment. We've got, I'm Mark Maron, by the way. That's Mark Riley. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Yep.
The number is 866-303-2270. If you have a sin you want to confess, we're on the phone with Chris in Boston, who plays on a amateur hockey team. And he's got a member of his team who is a conservative, belligerent, narrow-minded conservative. And Chris feels like he's being a liability to the team because he doesn't want to play with this guy, and he doesn't ever give him the puck, and he thinks it's screwing up the team's chemistry. Am I right?
Well, yeah, it's a recent discovery, and I just have not been able to actually deal with it yet.
All right, dude. So the other teams you play, some friends of yours on the other teams?
No, not really. It's just like it's a new league I've been playing in, and just a brand new bunch of people.
Well, here's a way to meet friends, and this is your penance. Maybe, before the game when the other team's showing up, you know, go say hi to them and, make some small talk and, find out where they stand politically a little bit and then tell them about this guy and have some members of the other team just, destroy him, run him into the wall, throw him onto the ice. And usually these conservatives, if they're bullied, if you actually are able to bully the bully, they cry really quickly. And when you see them crying, then I think you'll be released from this this process.
That'd be perfect.
So the goal for you is to, not at your own hands, but at the hands of others, make the conservative cry and then let it go.
Okay, thank you, Mark and Mark.
All right. Wow, he took that real serious, didn't he?
I think just the thought of watching him cry. All right, Jennifer. Oh, it's my friend Jennifer who came to see me the other night. What's your sin, Jennifer?
Oh, my God, Mark. Oh, I went to McDonald's before your show at Symphony Space.
Uh-huh.
I was so embarrassed.
Okay.
It had been 5 years because the last time I was on a car trip to New Hampshire.
Oh, man, I'm so right on board with this with you. I have this weird thing with McDonald's myself.
It was bad, but your show was so fun. I had such a great time.
Oh, thanks. Well, what are we going to do about this McDonald's issue?
Because I don't know. I've been eating salad and salmon.
To erase it?
Nothing else.
Counteract the McDonald's damage?
Yes, and like chugging gallons of water. I just feel terrible.
Well, I think that the sad thing is that you went ahead and did it, and you didn't have to do it. Like, usually if I eat a McDonald's, I'm at the airport, and I think it's like the time-free zone. Like, I'm not in a real place.
Well,
McDonald's doesn't count here.
I rationalized this because I'd been working all day, and I hadn't eaten lunch. I'd been eating, like, handfuls of nuts all day, and I was 15 minutes to your show, but it's...
So you deserved a break today? Is that what you're saying?
But I even thought, well, Mark gave up meat. Should I really be doing this?
Come on.
Is this the one, Jennifer, on Broadway by 96th Street?
That is correct.
In Manhattan, I know exactly which one you're talking about.
And it's horrible in there. It's like a day room of some lunatic asylum.
They do that on purpose so you don't hang around. So what did you eat?
Quarter pounder.
Oh, that's bad.
And a Diet Coke. That makes a lot of sense.
Why do you always do the Diet Coke? For the quarter pounders, like, they scare me because it's a little too much meat. And I'm a girl, too. I always get the Diet Coke with the fries.
I know. Oh, I had those, too.
Oh, what are we going to do with you? I think maybe... how about...
God, I'm so glad Eric Schlosser isn't there today, because what he would tell me would just... It would be horrifying.
But he'd rationalize the fries, though, because he admits in that book that he's still a fan of the fries.
I know, but you read that book, and, I mean, my guilt is overwhelming.
Okay. All right.
Wait a minute. Don't they put something in the fries to make you Jones on them or something? Wasn't that an urban myth about...
It is an urban myth. I just think they have really good fries. Man, I want a hamburger.
I don't even sell them this early.
I don't feel nearly as bad as that guy wants to kill cripples.
I know. Well, maybe you should get yourself a fat suit and maybe walk around in that for a month.
Oh, my God. That's really hard.
especially where you get a fat suit. But, I mean, maybe you could do that. Or I think what you're doing is probably pretty good to continue the purge.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant torturing myself.
No, well, I just assume you do that all the time.
I do.
I'm sure you do. If you came to see me and you're calling me with this this guilt over this.
I know, 5 days later.
We have a lot in common. Are you the Jennifer I just met the other night?
No.
Okay.
No, but I did sit near your mother.
But it was my aunt.
No, she was... was that your aunt?
That, when she had black hair and she was, like, laughing like she has tuberculosis?
She was very stylish. Very
really?
Thin and stylish. And
yes.
She said, Mark is my... What did she say? Mark's my...
My little boy or something?
I don't know.
Like,
she was talking about you, and she's...
My little man.
She thinks you're wonderful.
Oh, yeah, no, my Aunt Barbara's, it was nice.
Oh, I thought she was your mother.
No, my mom wasn't there.
Because I was looking for Jack Jazz Guy.
No. John the Jazz Man didn't come, and my mother wasn't there. Maybe next time.
John.
But Barbara is, I hadn't seen her in a while. It was nice to see her. But if my mom was there, I would have...
You would have known it.
I would have said something.
Oh.
I would have pointed and said, she did it! She's the one! All right, so I'd say for your penance, just, don't do it. You know, kale.
Okay. Yeah, kale, okay.
There you
do
go.
You like kale?
Sure.
Well, what don't you like? What's a vegetable you don't like?
I don't like cauliflower. I think it's vile.
Cauliflower gives you gas. I don't want to do that. You know what? Do cauliflower. You have to eat a mound of cauliflower every day. No, Jennifer, you're sweet.
Thank you. I love both you guys.
Thank you very
Jennifer.
Much. Talk to you later.
Bye.
It's so nice. I felt like there was that moment where I'm like, I'm not doing a radio show. I'm just talking to my friend Jennifer.
Yeah, right.
Let's see. Do we have time? We have 1 minute. A quick one. Okay, Cindy, is it quick? How are you, Cindy? What's your sin?
I'm doing just fine. My sin is that secretly, whenever someone tags me a liberal elitist, I don't mind the word elitist.
What, you're proud of it?
It doesn't bother me.
That's so snobby.
It is kind of snobby. It's kind of snobby, but in my mind, I'm always thinking, what is more elite than thinking that your God made the earth and that you're going to heaven?
Right. Right. That where's the logic? That when you die, you get wings and eternal life. That's ridiculous.
And that your God made the earth.
Oh, my God. You are an elitist. Take it easy.
I know. I am an elitist. fetus. I have a good education. I have a functional brain.
Sounds to me like someone needs to spend a little more time with the common folk.
Yeah.
What's funny is I live in a neighborhood full of working class people, and my house costs $60,000.
Oh, well. Yeah. Well, I think then maybe you should stop going outdoors with your princess robe on or whatever it is. Yeah, you're just your penance is to listen to the regular people. Okay, Cindy?
There you go.
All right, 57 past the hour. What do we got? It's great. We got Donald Bogle coming up. Bright Boulevard's Bold Dreams About Black Hollywood.
Yeah, he's going to talk a little bit about the Oscars. 5 out of the 20 nominees are African Americans this year. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more when we come back on Air America Radio.
Morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes at 6 past the hour. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Yep.
This show is called Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Thank you for doing that. We appreciate you being here. It's been quite a day so far. Pretty good. Now, I want to thank Linda in Florida for sending me the Pills for Cats books. You don't know how much stuff I get from my cats. You know, we get a lot of nice stuff from listeners, but
yeah,
this book, this is a very odd little book. It's a little cartoon book about this cat who's sad and then eventually tries every kind of medication available to people and has a very great time doing it, but looks a little, look at him at the end, he's a little, changes.
Oh, yeah.
All right, but thank you. That was very nice of you to send me that.
By the way.
Yes, sir.
The CDs, you got one and I got one. Do you remember who sent them?
Jared?
No, not Jared. The second set.
Oh, yeah, I got to check. I think Deborah in Wyoming sent us a couple CDs as well.
Yeah, yep. But whoever it was sent me a really fantastic mix of stuff.
Man, people are so nice.
They really are.
You know, I forget how nice people are, but you know who aren't nice? People who eat dogs. People who eat dogs and cats aren't nice. I know you just throw me this story. I'm like, well, go right to it. A state legislator is pushing a bill in Honolulu, in Hawaii, that would ban the slaughter of dogs and cats for foods, drawing protests from members of some Asian ethnic groups who believe the measure is aimed at unfounded and racist stereotypes of this culture. Well, why are they... Why are they reacting if it, you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you're being racist, and we should be able to eat dogs and cats.
I don't know if that's what they're saying. It's
sort of like outlawing chicken killing for voodoo doctors.
Well, you'll never do that.
No. Well they're going to do it anyways. But nonetheless, now I got to look at my cats in this whole other way. Because sometimes I'm walking in Queens, I see rabbits in the window, you know, the dead rabbits.
Yeah.
And in Queens, there's no shortage of displayed meat products in the windows. You know, heads, brains, dangling carcasses of all sorts.
Yeah.
And I've been off the meat for now a few weeks. And again, you know what? Thank you also for all the vegetarian pamphlets, booklets, guidelines. Man, I get all kinds of stuff that I've actually read. I made a couple, I don't want to sound all weird, but I made a couple recipes out of this vegetarian guideline book that someone sent me. I'm having a little hard time with the amount of grains and beans I'm taking in. But here's a story out of England that it's apparently some say that some scientists say that if you deny children meat, it will cause them developmental damage, that they won't grow as tall, that they won't be as strong, and some people think that there's definitely two sides of this argument. I know that when I first got my cats, if you got to give them a little raw meat so they develop the bacteria to digest it properly, but I would imagine Paul McCartney said that's rubbish. I'm using his words. Rubbish. He raised all his kids in the vegetarian way, and they're all fine. He says they're no shorter than ordinary kids. But I wonder, because I don't know for sure, if someone could send me some information on this, I'd appreciate it, that the food pyramid apparently was some sort of sham created by the agricultural industry to sell milk and meat and cheese products, that, you know, the amount that supposedly you needed.
Oh, the four basic food groups and the minimum daily adult requirements and all
sham.
That stuff.
Just a sham.
That was a scheme? A game?
Well, I mean, people need certain things, but you don't need certain things either. You certainly don't need as much meat, as they said, because clearly people do fine without meat. There's other ways to get protein. I haven't quite figured those out yet. But I'm not hurting. I'm very strong. Look at me, Chris, strong. See how strong I am?
Little chubby.
No. Oh, wow.
Now, that was unkind.
Are you serious?
That was an unkind cut, Chris
LaPresta. You're more of a man than you used to be.
What are you talking about?
You bulked up a little bit.
Is that true?
I'm just a little bit.
Look at my butt. Does it look fat?
No.
Am I in these pants?
It's not in your butt. Just the stomach area.
What are you talking about? Wait a minute. Wait, how about if I take these? Look, I'm going to take them off. How does it look now? What's the matter? You scared? What are you scared of?
Come on, take them off.
No, I'm not.
Come on.
All right.
Yeah. Come on. Family radio.
There's no fat,
I guess.
No? You're sucking it in.
So what? What are you supposed to do? What are you supposed to do, Chubbs? What are you talking about? Mr. Costco, pizza eating.
Hey, I'm not the one that's not eating meat, man.
I know that. And whatever you eat to make you fat, what are you voting busted my balls for?
He works out, though.
I'm fine.
Both of you work out now that I think
about it. Huh?
Why don't we have a tractor pull between you and Chris LaPresta?
This is ridiculous.
Let's settle this like men. Is there anyone here?
look, buddy. Now, the thing is, you're right. All right. Now,
said you are getting chubby.
How do you be a vegetarian and eat grain and oats and beans and tofu all day and not get that weird ghee belly? You know, that's what I call the when you see some Indian women who are in their traditional garments. That they get sort of some of them get sort of a buttery kind of fat from eating all the ghee. That's my theory, and I think it's a vegetarian thing. I don't eat ghee myself, but eat a lot more oil and stuff, so I feel like I'm getting ghee belly.
Interesting. Yeah. I can almost see it, actually.
Stop it.
No, seriously. Stop sucking it in.
Oh,
Jim Earl is not a fat man. Did you see Jim Earl? He's a lanky dude, but that's genetic.
Earl has no power whatsoever.
Like, what do you mean, no power?
A stiff breeze can knock him over.
Oh.
Well, what I want to know about is like, what do people really need? I think it's a big sham about how much protein you really need. And I don't miss it, Chris. I don't miss the chicken because I didn't eat it. I don't miss the steak because I ate that like once or twice a month. I miss, you know what I miss? The sliced turkey breast. And I miss an occasional pork chop and a slab of bacon.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to have a pork chop tomorrow, man.
You are?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know what they feed pigs?
You know what?
What? Have you ever seen
so
a piggy?
Good.
Have you ever seen? And pigs are cute. They're almost like people. You know?
Right.
But that's not really the
reason. Nice thin pork chop.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
All right. Maybe
some
right.
pepper.
Okay, all right.
Ooh.
I get it. It's the bacon I miss, but not even that much.
I miss bacon, and I haven't eaten it in over a decade.
Chicken doesn't even taste like chicken anymore, man.
No, you got to get the right chicken, man.
You got to get a really good chicken.
You got to get some B&E, or you got to
Murray's.
Get, well, you know, so yeah, Murray's, B&E, wherever.
I think
there's
Empire.
Some people that still do, yeah, Empire's good too. Still do chicken the way it's supposed. Kosher chicken, for some reason, to me tastes better than ordinary chicken.
That's because they trick the chicken. They're praying and they clock them in the middle of a prayer. They're like, no, bochatana, no pink. And they just take them out right at the moment where the chicken is going, pink. Smack them. Cut the head right off.
Wow.
Yeah,
is that
what it is? No, I don't know. You know, all I know is when I was in Mexico, the chickens look different. They've bred them to grow quicker and to be more efficient. They've made these mutant chickens. And when I was in Mexico, the chickens look like rubber chickens look, you know, that yellow, weird-looking, real chicken look. These look like they had that yellow color and the flavor was much different. We've mutated these animals to such a degree. We've shot them up with so much medicine and so many antibiotics, and we grow them in these cages. And it's a factory. It's not
sometimes
really livestock.
Sometimes it really
anymore.
Does end up just tasting like anything but chicken.
And there's
I can't
a myth.
Even describe
it's a myth
it.
Of free-range animals and that there's healthy meat. I mean, it's like, what do we think? That like they, just because they don't feed the cow any chemicals or antibiotics or anything, that you're not still eating just a tense little fear burger. I mean, it's not like they autoerotically asphyxiate these cows at the moment of climax, so they're completely relaxed. I mean, no matter what kind of meat you eat, you're basically just eating processed fear. There you go. Dig
Uh-oh.
It. I'm going to get shot by a meat lobbyist. That's how I'm going to go. It's like, there's the guy.
You heard what they did.
What do you have to say about burgers now? You're going to end up burgers. Take his body. Let's throw him in the grinder, like Prime Cut with Lee Marvin and Gene Hackman. Do you remember that movie? That's an old movie. Wasn't it called Prime Cut? We got to look it up.
We got to look it up.
It was one of those movies I saw when I was a kid. It was an R-rated movie. I just remembered that they made a guy into sausages. It was about two competing meatpacking firms. We got to look it up.
I remember Motel Hell. They actually grew people in their backyard for sausage.
Well, you know, Riley, they really do that. We'll talk about that in a second. It's 14 past the hour on Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Are you serious? Okay with those? I mean, do I really look fat? I mean, it's not that I care. It's not that I care, but I'm trying to stay healthy, and I've been sick for... It's 19 past the hour, Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes.
That's Kayla the Costco Ho, noodle addict. All right? Noodle addict. Cup of noodle addict. All right. No, look. You know, I've been sick for a couple... You know what I mean? I had the cold. I haven't been able to go to the gym. You know, I'm trying to adjust to a new diet. I'm trying to take care of myself, and you got to take a shot at me like that?
I'm not taking a shot. I'm just saying, you know what'll fix all of your worries?
How is meat going to make me look any... make me any less fat?
It's going to make you... First of all, it's going to make you less fat, because you can burn that off besides soy and your beans.
Beans and grain.
Oof.
Grain. It's good, man. It's got to be good for you. Think about... people who lived off of that for the healthiest diet in the
people
world.
People killed animals.
No.
No, it goes back so long.
If they were lucky, one guy killed the animals and dragged it back to the restroom. If they were lucky, other than that, just small nuts, leafy things,
and then
things
they
pulled out of the ground. No, the Tuscan diet in Tuscany, a lot of beans, a lot of oil, healthiest diet in the world. Occasionally some meat, right? But not a lot of meat. Do you understand? Not a lot of meat. Occasionally a wild boar. Okay.
Oh, boar.
They ever been there?
Oh,
you go to Tuscany.
Good.
They got big old.
Can someone get me some boar?
Sure, we. I'm telling you, if you're in Italy, you go into these salamerias, these meat marcellerias or whatever they are, and they have, you know, how prosciutto looks, you know, with the whole leg,
yeah,
of prosciutto. Well, they have those, but the leg's all hairy because it's a boar leg, and they leave the hair on. It's the weirdest thing you ever saw.
Ooh.
Why don't you go to Italy? I thought you were. Are you going
to
go?
I'm going to try to. I need some money for it.
All right. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So you know what I did? I bought myself a brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Yes, I did. Let's crank this baby up and feed it some headlines. All right, from the New York Times, Bush says Russia must make good on democracy. Bush says Russia must make good on democracy. Translation, Bush coughs in the fist to avoid extended laughing jag. Do-do-pow-pow. All right, from Fox News, Falwell hospitalized with infection. Falwell hospitalized with infection. Translation, evangelist blames satanic microbes, sues Larry Flint. All right, from the New York Times, new course by Royal Navy, a campaign to recruit gays. Here we go. Translation, British Navy christens HMS Freddie Mercury. I wish we had that. You know, I want to replace that tape with Brendan P.W. McDonald telling me what it was. I so badly wish I had that moment encapsulated forever. I wish that was going to be in the documentary we were going to see this afternoon of Air America's rough beginnings instead of me screaming at Larson and Larson going, oh, no, why did I take this job? Larson, 45 pounds before what he is now. Can you imagine that? He's going to see himself, how much screen he's going to be taking up, just sitting there wondering what Larson's in widescreen, everyone else is in regular screen. It's going to be sad. But I'm so glad you're so much healthier and you look so much better. I got to get back on the points, man. All right, but here, wait. I just want to hear Brendan do this. Ba 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 ba. I really want to replace that, this.
Well, here he comes.
Because remember when I asked you that, Brendan?
Yeah.
I was like, you know, what'd you put on there?
Well, I wanted to give you an accurate representation of what you're going to hear.
Let's hear it, man.
Well, which one? We want the intro or the outro?
I don't care.
All right. Well,
give me the outro.
Well, the outro was just... But the beginning is the better part. Because it's like...
It's trailing off, I think.
Right, you really get that once.
It. Okay,
that
thank you. It. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in from the booth to do that. It's the trailing off that's all right, let's do. Okay, come on. We got things to talk about. Now, you are a member of the Anglican Church, are you not?
Well, I'm an Episcopalian.
Okay, and that is a subsidiary,
a subsidiary
franchise
of the Anglican Church, yes.
Okay, holy. Owned by the Anglican Church.
Well, it includes the Church of England, the Church of Nigeria, Nippon Seiko Kai, which is a Japanese church. They're all together.
Okay, all right. So now there's a schism, a great schism in the Anglican Church about, you know, how to treat homosexuality.
Yes.
And it looks like it might fracture the church. Am I right?
Yeah, it looks like it might fracture the church. In fact, primates from the Anglican Communion met in Northern Ireland to try and save the denomination, because many of the more conservative traditional congregations and dioceses object very strongly to two things that the Episcopal Church in the United States has done. One, of course, is to make Eugene Robinson a bishop, the Bishop of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is the Diocese of New Westminster in Vancouver, British Columbia, has authorized the service of blessing for same-sex couples.
You know, we had Gene Robinson on this show
early on.
Lovely man. Great conversation. We do have a little bit of him talking about what we're talking about right now. This is from what feels like years ago.
June of last year.
Wow, it's almost been a year we've been on the air. Let's hear from the Bishop?
Bishop Eugene
Bishop Robinson.
I think the biggest problem here is that we have let the religious right speak for all Christians, and mainline Christians are not in the same place that the religious right is. I also think that we are so generally bought into the culture with our tax-exempt status and so on, it's very hard to bite the hand that feeds you. And I'm not sure that we'll ever reclaim our prophetic role until we're not so in bed with the government.
I just don't understand why there can't be a level of acceptance around these issues, you know, and that what exactly is he saying in terms of tax-exempt status and acting like a government?
Well, I mean, when it comes to the issue of the tax-exempt status, no church wants to have its tax-exempt status jeopardized
right. In
any way, shape, or form. And at the root of the schism in the Anglican Communion is around the question of whether or not if these conservative or traditional churches break away somehow,
mm-hmm.
how much of the churches, of the communion's assets can they take with them?
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not they will continue to maintain some form of tax-exempt status, given certainly inside the United States, given the idea that people are taking a long look at that with churches generally anyway.
Okay.
Okay. So at a point, and what's happened is that conservative churches inside the United States have found common cause with, for example, the Church of Nigeria. Which has taken a very strong stand against any form of gay recognition, and in fact has threatened to split away if the American Episcopal Church doesn't renounce its liberalized posture on making gays members of the clergy.
Why can't we evolve? We're going to have Donald Bogle in here in a matter of moments to talk about black history in Hollywood.
Yes. He's the author of Bright Boulevard's Bold Dream.
And Planet Bush
when we come back.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. There.
Good morning.
The program is Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Donald Bogle will be out here soon to talk about his book Bright Boulevards, Bold Dreams: The Story of Black Hollywood. But first, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now, on the phone once again is Planet Push correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's making an omelet, and he's cracking open your soul.
Oh, good one. Okay.
Frying it up in butter.
All right. Okay, all right. So Bush is in Europe, my friend.
Oh, you Yeah. Just gave me goosebumps.
Really?
You realize that? Bush in Europe. I think it's magnificent the way President Bush is sacrificing himself to help all those people.
What are you talking about? What is he sacrificing?
Well, he made that long, hard plane trip all the way over there just to bring our culture to those poor, ignorant people.
What are you talking about?
Those dirty peasants need to be exposed to American culture so they can come up to our level. They need to see it in action. It's a little thing called compassion. He's built his whole presidency.
What are you talking about, Lon? It's Europe.
Look at France. Look at what those people eat.
Come on.
Look at what they wear. Have you ever seen anything so sad, so tragic?
Those
people are going to welcome him with flowers and songs and parades, just like they did in Iraq.
Oh, right, just like they did in Iraq. All right, look, it's become clear. It's become clear to me, Lawton, that you hate him in Europe. Is that right? They hate him there.
Maybe a few scattered fanatics, communists, something like that. But Mark,
yes.
You can't expect somewhere as backward as Europe to understand George W. Bush's sophisticated plan for the world. That's unrealistic.
Oh, come on.
That's like expecting a place like New York or Los Angeles to get it. They're not ready.
No, come on. It's Bush who doesn't listen to me. It's Bush that doesn't understand Europe, my friend. He has routinely patronized them and bullied them and shut them out. Do you know that Bush had never even been to Europe before he became president? Do you know that?
Well, there's no point, Mark. He hasn't been to the moon either, but we all know it's a barren wasteland.
Come on.
Tell me where you'd rather be, some crumbling old piazza in Rome or a shiny new gated community outside of town?
Oh, my God.
No
awful.
Contest.
Awful. You're
no
jealous.
No contest at all.
You're jealous, Lawton. You're jealous.
Bring them. Come.
You're jealous. You love Europe. You hate what America's become, and the fact that Bush represents our country embarrasses you, doesn't it? Admit it. Yes. Yes. There you go. Don't you feel better? Yes. There you go. See? I knew you had that in you. I did.
I'm a homeless too.
Yeah, see that? Not so bad, is it?
He has a mandate there too, Mark.
Oh, come on.
You don't
see that?
He does, he can change Social Security there anytime.
No, goodbye, Lon. We've had enough. Goodbye, Lon.
God loves you.
No.
Deal with it.
All right.
Mind you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Lon Smalls. In the studio with us now is a film historian. He teaches at the Tisch School for the Arts at New York University and at the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of the new book, Bright Boulevard, Bold Dreams, A Story of Black Hollywood. Donald Vogel, thank you for being here. How are you?
Great to be here, Mark.
It's nice to see you.
Thanks for coming.
Mark.
this book looks fascinating to me because you do it, chronologically. You deal with the film, the history of blacks in cinema in the teens, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, all the way through. Now, what is the primary arc of evolution? Where does it start and what takes place? What are the big points, the historical points?
Well, I should tell you what this book sets out to cover, which is different from my previous books. I've dealt with images of African Americans in the movies before. My book, Toms, Coons, Mulattoes, Mammies, and Bucks, deals very much with these distorted images of African Americans in American cinema from the early years of the 20th century up to the present. And it also looks at the achievements of particular actors and actresses. This book looks at what happens when the cameras weren't rolling.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks at the way in which African Americans really had to push to get a place within the film industry.
Right.
And then it charts the changes that come about with them once they start to get roles, then questioning the roles. And then it also looks very much at the community itself, because many people don't realize that in Los Angeles, this whole concept of Black Hollywood, it was a real place, because in Los Angeles there were restrictive covenants that prohibited African Americans from living in certain parts of the city. So you had a very vital black community with their own nightclubs, their own hotels. So the book charts that as well. But it really, in looking at Black Hollywood, the beginning starts with a woman by the name of Madame Sulte Juan.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a funny character, a very interesting character. That wasn't her real name, by the way.
Sure.
Her real name was Nellie Connelly. And she comes to the West Coast. She'd been born in Kentucky, and she's got three kids. Her husband's left her. She's looking for work. She's got to take care of the kids, and she strikes up a friendship with, of all people, D.W. Griffith,
wow,
the director of The Birth of a Nation. And as a matter of fact, she actually worked on the film. If you see Birth of a Nation today, the major black characters in Birth of a Nation are played by whites in blackface. I mean, yes. Griffith doesn't even think black people can play themselves in these major roles. But you'll see real blacks in small roles. And Madame Sultaywan, in striking up this friendship with Griffith, she cleaned out dressing rooms and she played little bits in the movie as well. So it starts there.
Okay.
And follows through.
You know, the thing that amazed me about that whole story with Madame Sultaywan, aside from the fact that, you know, D.W. Griffith is probably best known for, you know, an extraordinarily racist screed in Birth of a Nation, although it was a very innovative film at the time. But the thing that struck me was one little thing you put in there, which is one of the things I love about all your books. The idea that some of the white actors did blackface at one point in the film and then played white characters in other parts of the film. Griffith really kind of economized throughout the filming.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. Lillian Gish had talked about that they would switch around and play different parts. And Madame Sultaywan as well played different, you know, as a real African-American film, played different parts in the film too. But you know what's interesting about Madame Sultaywan and this whole thing with D.W. Griffith is that I'm sure when the film was being made, she had no idea what the final
how
thing,
racist
yes,
it was
yes,
going to
yes,
end
yes,
up
yes.
looking. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think she realized that. And the thing was that Griffith had come to her rescue financially and so forth. So she had this friendship that went on for decades, but she really never dealt seriously with what those images in that film had been about. But I'll say this also, when we talk about Black Hollywood, what's very interesting is from the very beginning, when Birth of a Nation comes out, you do get resistance and you get dissent. There's a black newspaper in Los Angeles called the California Eagle, which is publishing from the teens. It ceases publication in the 60s, but it very much stays on that movie. So early on, they realize the power of images. But nonetheless, the book follows through with Madam, who keeps who stays in the community for decades and who actually becomes admired by many of the people, the new people coming there. And then it shows what happens when talking motion pictures come in, sound films, and real black actors and actresses start to get more work. And then it does look at on screen and off these crucial differences. I mean, you get someone like Stephen Fetchett, who really, for all of us today, I mean, he's pretty hard to take when you see him in his movies. He's this archetypal coon figure. But what's fascinating about Fetchett is that Fetchett, off-screen, was nothing
person.
Like this.
Yeah.
Nothing. I mean, he lived in high style. He, you know, had mansions, cars, women. And the black community in Los Angeles at that time, when he first started to get work, Stephen Fetchett was seen as this important figure in terms of changing the movie industry.
Talk a bit about when the black presence in Hollywood reached critical mass. Obviously, you talk about Madame Sultaywan. That was in the teens. That was when Hollywood was just evolving as a film center. They had shot films in New York and other places before then. When did the black presence in Hollywood evolve as Hollywood evolved, or did the large numbers of black actors start coming later?
Well, they do. The black presence does evolve as the industry does, because the industry in the beginning, when Madame Sultaywan gets there, we don't yet have the really powerful studios, and the star system has started. But as all of that grows, more and more come. Some become servants for big stars, and the black servants were very interesting because they realized that in Hollywood, if you know a secret, you've got some power or you've
currency.
Got influence. And so the black servants, they were very interesting people that they knew how to play on this. And then in the 30s with the industry, I mean, so solidly built up by then, you do get a lot of a number of African Americans that people know working in Hollywood movies. I mean, Paul Robeson comes from the East Coast to work there. Freddie Washington's in the original Imitation of Life. Hattie McDaniel.
What a gorgeous woman Freddie Washington was. My God, she was fine. I mean, I just had to say that.
She was. I mean, the interesting thing about Washington was that, you know, Mark, I had interviewed Freddie Washington many years ago when I first started to research about African Americans in films. And at that time, she was living in Connecticut. She didn't see many people. And she was one of the people that really, in a sense, led to this book, because Freddie Washington was an East Coast actress. She was a great admirer of, like, Paul Robeson, with whom she had worked, and Duke Ellington. And when she had gone west to appear in Imitation of Life, the 1934 version, she plays the light-skinned black girl who passes for white. Now, when they remade the film 25 years later, 1959, they did not use an African-American actress in the part of the mulatto. But Freddie Washington was highly intelligent, and she saw the industry for what it was and the limitations for African-Americans there. Yet, Freddie Washington very much saw the spirit of the black community there. I mean, all of this energy that was there, and the nightclub scene, because the studios would go to the black clubs. They'd send their scouts out looking for talent in those clubs. They didn't know what to do with the talent once they got it, but they did very much pay attention to what was going on within the black community.
We're talking to Donald Bogle. The book is Bright Boulevards, Bold Dreams, the story of Black Hollywood. We will be back to talk about modern Hollywood and maybe a little Oscar talk, if that's okay with you, Donald.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. So it's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
All right, 50 past the hour. We're going to land this thing. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yep.
Our guest here in the studio is Donald Bogle. His new book, Bright Boulevards, Bold Dreams, The Story of Black Hollywood, is, I believe, your sixth book.
Yes, it
am
is.
Am I right?
Yeah.
Tremendous. You can get the book on our website, morningsedition.com, and it will also connect you to some of his other books. We are up to the 40s and 50s, which is where the identity of black
the real shift comes about. I mean, Lena Horne comes to Hollywood. She doesn't play maids. She's, you know, glamorized, publicized. The book follows through with, you know, the rise of, like, Dorothy Dandridge, Sammy Davis Jr., Nat King Cole, when also black Hollywood changes in the sense that Hollywood itself becomes more integrated, on the surface, at least. So, so the book has really just a whole set of stories. Also, there is the choreographer, Marie Bryant, who people know nothing about.
Right,
lot of people working behind the scenes that you've never heard of. So the book deals with all that, and lots of photographs as well.
Yeah. You know, I always wondered, did you get a sense that the black community celebrated or was upset about Hattie McDaniel's winning the Oscar for Gone Girl?
Well, Hattie McDaniel was an integral part of the community in Los Angeles, and this is one of the things, I guess, in a sense, a paradox. On the one hand, the community was very happy to see that she had won it, because she certainly deserved it. It is a great performance, no matter what we see in that script and the problems, but the subtext of her performance is very, very powerful. But interesting enough, after she wins the Oscar, it does begin to mark a shift, because now African Americans have gotten in there, they've gotten these roles, but there starts to be, during the Second World War, more questioning of what these roles actually are.
Now, what about today? Would you still say there is a black community in Hollywood today, and how are they represented now?
Well, there is a black community still today. The difference is that now black stars can pretty much live wherever they want. They can go to whatever restaurants they want. Los Angeles had been a very segregated city. The interesting thing today, which I find, is that we now do have certain black male stars, Denzel Washington, Will Smith, Morgan Freeman, Jamie Foxx would be in that, people who command these multi-million-dollar salaries who are superstars. But there are still barriers there in the industry.
Like what?
Well, African-American women still have a very difficult time of it. I mean, even Halle Berry winning that Oscar, what has happened to that career.
Yeah.
I mean, she made a mistake with Catwoman. But
yes,
you know, big mistake. But you know, what kind of roles is she offered? You know, there are really only two black women that they have any interest in. I mean, and even there, it's restricted. And they are Halle Berry and Queen Latifah.
Sure.
And that's really it. Angela Bassett, one of these.
She's a fine actress.
Yes, and has
She's
this
great.
Real movie star weight on screen. What has happened to that career? So the industry, there are still those barriers up. You know, this year we see it as historic for the first time. We do have these five acting nominations, Jamie Foxx in two categories. And I think that, you know, it's a great move forward. Whether or not this is a fluke. Is something else.
Which do you think was, just out of curiosity, to get off the academic trajectory or the trajectory of history, which Jamie Foxx performance did you find to be the better performance of the two that he's nominated for?
I'd say Ray. I thought he was very good in Collateral.
I did too.
Yeah, but I guess I would say Ray.
What did you think about Chris Rock saying that straight men don't watch the Oscars? It seems like he's getting a little flack for that.
Yeah, well, Chris Rock, I mean, I think that he's trying to be provocative. And if anything, he wants to pull an audience in to see how outrageous he can be. It's going to be a tough night for him. It's a tough night for any host of the Oscars. So he's been brought in to really, in a sense, be controversial, to be edgy. And I think that's what he's doing in promoting it right now.
Yeah. No, I guess he said no black straight. Did he say no black straight?
He said something to that effect, yeah.
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 Well, I thought that whole ad campaign was a little forced.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, he's got to get in there and get people watching. And so, you know, I think people are going to be turning on to see what Chris Rock actually does.
So who do you think is going to win, Professor?
You know, don't call me Professor. Call me Doctor. I mean, I hope I'm not sounding too academic.
Oh, no,
the
no,
last
no,
thing
no,
I wanted to do.
You're absolutely
but,
not.
Who's going to win? You know, Jamie Foxx right now is the front runner. But, you know, frankly, I think that it would be something to watch Clint Eastwood as actor, because a lot of those Academy people are older, and he's never won an acting award. Probably shouldn't have, but he's better in this. And I think there's a chance. I think Morgan Freeman has a very, very good chance of getting it. It's long overdue.
Donald Bogle, thank you for being with us. The book
appreciate
is
it.
Bright
My
Bold
pleasure.
Hearts, Bold Dreams, The Story of Black Hollywood. You weren't being academic at all. I just thought I'd mix it up a little bit.
Okay.
I use professor with respect. Okay.
All right. Good.
All right. There's the facts coming in from the Streisand compound. Here are your liberal marching orders for today. Write these down. One, call all your European friends and tell them if they want Bush to stay there permanently, it's okay with us. Two, casually tell that annoying neocon at the office, I can't believe Jeff Gordon beat Dale Jr. to win the Daytona 500. Looks like it's a number three for old Jeff. And wait for a reaction. Three, secretly start tape recording your friends for history, not money. Four, recover from last night's Lincoln's fabulous gay birthday rail splitters ball. And five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. The leaders of Europe only get to ask Bush one question. Well, I got a million questions. And they all end with, how do you sleep, murderer? Wake up, sheeple. You drank the Kool-Aid. Thank you again, Donald Bogle, for sitting through this.
So much.
Thanks, Mark.
Much appreciated. And, of course, we're going to be back tomorrow morning to do the whole thing over again, Mark Maron.
Again and again.
That's right.
What do we got here?
We've got some authors that are going to be joining us tomorrow.
The people that made the exonerated.
The exonerated, yeah. So we're going to get a chance to talk about that. This, of course, is a death penalty situation that a lot of people are paying very close attention to. And it'll be here for you tomorrow morning here on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Maron.
You too. Riley.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.